Their case.
Reasoning is that we've already said that where there where discrimination claims exist, there are retaliation claims. That's the reasoning of it. But there, no one has ever held.
They're waiting on you.
Okay, General Petrani.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Title VII is Congress's comprehensive remedial statute for private party claims of sex discrimination in employment. Among other things, Title VII has detailed administrative exhaustion requirements, limitations periods, venue, substantive standards, and most importantly, an express textual cause of action.
So, counsel, let me jump in because we don't have a ton of time together. I'll tell you what I'm struggling isn't the right way to do it, but that I need clarification or help with. What is the intersection between what I'll call or what y'all call this preclusion analysis with implied causes of action? Because it seems to me that we're in a situation where there's two things that are covering one situation, then we have to decide either are they complementary or are they precluded? That's easy. But where we don't know whether something exists, that certainly goes into the preclusion analysis, which is, I think, what Judge Carnes referenced. But it also seems to me that, and I think you dance around this in the brief, I'm not sure you actually hit it directly, of is there really anything to preclude where it doesn't really exist? So on the one hand, where a Title VII claim, where a Title IX implied right of action isn't covered by Title VII, which seems to be one of the claims in the Joseph case, the Jackson-related one, then that wouldn't be precluded, and you seem to agree. So where they're not overlapping, then we don't do preclusion. And if that's the case, then where no one has ever implied a right of action, there doesn't seem to be anything that's overlapping, and what do we need to preclude? So that's a long question for you.
There's a lot in there, Your Honor. First of all, I apologize. Certainly we're not trying to dance around this question.
I didn't mean that in a bad way.
There are two levels to it, right? Because as we made clear in our brief, there are two separate ways that we could win in Crowther. One is to say, just assume that Title IX has this kind of private right of action here. Title VII precludes. Like, just assume that there's some kind of right here. Title VII precludes, and we think the text, history, structure, case law makes that very clear.
But what it would preclude is would be coextensive, right?
Yes.
It would be precluding what is already covered by Title VII.
Yeah, no. My point is that in Crowther, that's as far as it gets because there is no claim of some sort of employment discrimination, but not quite Title VII. The question in Crowther is just, is there, in fact, a
tell me what
sex discrimination in employment? So that's why we didn't directly address
it. But it covers the predicate question, though, of if it doesn't exist, then why bother with the preclusion analysis?
To hold that, and I think that would be the correct holding, and I'll give you, I think, three cases really demonstrate why. So Gebser, Alexander versus Sandoval, and Cummings. I mean, I'm not, coming up with anything novel here. The basic idea is this is a spending clause statute without a textual private right of action. In all three of those cases.
Although we have Jackson.
That's true. To be sure, Your Honor, that's true.
Isn't it weird to say that there's a Jackson retaliation implied right of action, but not an implied right of action for the sex discrimination itself that is covered by Title IX?
I don't think that's necessarily weird, Your Honor, because one of the ways that the way that Title IX is supposed to be enforced as a statutory matter is through administrative enforcement. So you don't have people coming in complaining. How is the federal government supposed to enforce the statute in the first place? How are they supposed to even learn about what's going on? That's very different from some.
So you would say, in a very basic sense, to make sense of that remedial scheme that the statute creates, you have to have the retaliation right.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas that is not at all the case with a direct, I want damages or something for myself. And in those cases, we have, again, two really important points. One, this comes out of Alexander versus Sandoval, where you do have an enforcement mechanism listed. existed.
Yeah.
You really should not be implying some other kind of enforcement mechanism. And the other one, and this comes out of Gebser, which it was itself a Title IX case, and then also Cummings just a couple years ago, where you have a spending clause statute, it's very important not to go outside of the bounds when it comes to private rights of action, because it's essentially an agreement between the recipient of the funds and the federal government. And so in Gebser, the court said, we don't think that states realized that the or universities.
Yeah, and there are federalism implications, Scott, too, about notice to the states.
Yes, so there are extensive problems there. So we are more than happy for the court to say we don't need to reach preclusion because actually there is no implied right of action going this far in the first place. The way we briefed it in this case is simply like you can do it under either analysis. If you just assume there is a right of action for Title IX cases, for Title IX claims of this sort, Title VII still precludes, given its extensive text structure and history of being the statute that Congress wanted to be used in this area. And we cite numerous cases that are almost directly on point, but I'll just focus on one in the short time we have. Johansson is almost word for word the same situation. You had the Federal Employee Compensation Act, a specific delineated statute about how federal employees are supposed to file certain suits. Then later, you have enacted the Public Vessels Act, which is just kind of a general statute about here's what you do if you're on a U.S. vessel and you get injured. And in that case, there were, in fact, causes of action under both. But the court said, Congress didn't impliedly get rid of this entire scheme for federal employees with this more broad statute.
But then there's Johnson. And they come back to Johnson, and I think rightly so, because it's hard to reconcile some of the earlier cases that you're referring to with Johnson. Now, I know your response is they said something different when the new amendments came out, when it came to federal employees. But still, we have to somehow reconcile all that.
So there are a couple things on that, Your Honor. The first, as you mentioned, in Brown, the court really stepped away from Johnson, and it did it in two ways that are particularly relevant here. One is it said, well, they only added federal employees in the EEOA. That's true with state employees, too. They had not been previously covered. And two, it said there are sovereign immunity concerns. The sovereign immunity concerns are different here because it's a spending clause statute and so forth, but there are serious federalism concerns with trying, with kind of allowing for this spending clause statute to win the day. But here's another really important point here. 1981 was almost a century old. I think it might have been exactly a century old at this point. And Johnson relied heavily on the legislative history, basically saying we don't want Title VII to displace already existing rights. Title IX comes after
Title VII.
And in fact, it comes 3 months after the EEOA. So the idea that that Congress said, we're now going to add educational institutions and state and federal employers, and then 3 months later, just kind of undo that with respect to educational institutions, because we're going to let you get out of all of the statutory requirements and just go straight to Title IX, that doesn't really make any sense. But I'd also add, one last thing I'd add about Johnson is, it's kind of the only case that they can rely on, and not only was it severely undercut by Brown, but then in Novotny, another Title VII preclusion case with 1985, the Supreme Court said, it does preclude. So I don't think that this one example where the court relied heavily on legislative history about a century-old statute really goes.
I want to ask you about another implied right of action thing, because they're asking us to, what seems to me, to extend Jackson in this case to not complaining about Title IX compliance, but the retaliation is that in the course of my investigation, that I participated in an investigation, that somehow was retaliatory, that I made a defense in a Title IX investigation. That is different than Jackson and any other case that I've ever seen, and at least one circuit that I can tell has said that is not really a Title IX claim. What do we do with that in the preclusion analysis also? Should we say, which sort of avenue should we take? Should we say that claim is really not a Jackson implied right of action and that is not one that we're willing to extend, and therefore we don't have to do anything? Or should we say that to the extent it exists, Title IX or Title VII precludes it?
Yeah, so I think probably there are two points there. First, I actually don't think they try to characterize their claim that way. I actually don't think you can, but let's just assume it's characterized the way Your Honor just did. I don't think, or I think the easiest way, or not the easiest, the fewest moving parts would be there just is no implied private right of action of that sort. And I think that that would be pretty important here to not kind of go beyond what...
Have we in our published opinions extended Jackson, even if not in this way, in any way outside the facts or the context of Jackson? In other words, based on resource allocation?
Oh, certainly not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, maybe I missed something, but I don't think so. I'm not aware of any case that extends Jackson beyond the clear situation presented in Jackson, which the court made clear was about the fact that if you can't, if you don't have some sort of claim for retaliation, no one is going to be raising these issues in the first place. That is very different from this case. What he's saying, and again, I actually don't think that he alleges this in his complaint, but what he's trying to say in his brief is, my participating in the investigation is what you retaliated against me for. That is not the sort of thing that is sort of going to be under the, you know, kind of foggy. You're going to know about those claims. It's not like, oh, I went around telling, you know, whistleblowing more or less and then got retaliated against. It's you came after me and then retaliated against me. So I'd like to, unless there are other questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Levy?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Adrienne Levy from Nessunoff and Miltenberg representing Thomas Crather. The narrow issue before the court is whether Title VII precludes Title IX gender discrimination claims by employees of federally funded education programs. The district court correctly held that it does not. This court should join the majority of circuit courts permitting employment discrimination claims under Title IX and affirm. As the Supreme Court noted in Palm Wonderful versus Coca-Cola, preclusion analysis is essentially a matter of statutory construction. And that
That's the irony of this, which is that we're not really construing the statute on the other side. In other words, in Palm and every other case that your opposing counsel went through, there were, in fact, statute A, statute B, and then we're trying to sort of piece it together. But we don't really have that. We have statute A, and we have the ethers of what the Supreme Court has told us regarding statute B. How do we put that together?
I think that, and if I can sort of address a question that was raised by Your Honors earlier with respect to whether there is already a right of action here specifically, there's not been a case before the Supreme Court yet that involved this specific fact pattern of an employee bringing a direct discrimination claim in a federally funded program. However, there are three Supreme Court cases that, when we combine them, all collectively sort of pull this case under their umbrella. So we have the case in Cannon, which is a case where the Supreme Court decided that there is a private right of action. And specifically, when looking to the text of Title IX, they noted that an applicant to schools was included as the class of people to be protected under Title IX. That was a key part of the
problem. And I know the sequence you're going to do, and I understand. And I don't mean to cut you off, but it's Cannon, Bell, and Jackson. I get it. But here's the issue that we have, and a few principles underlying it. One is any holding, including a Supreme Court holding, cannot hold anything beyond the facts of its case. And there, the facts of Cannon, as you know, were dealing with students. That's why they had to say and extend it to employees later on, because it didn't go to anyone else other than students. Bell is not, as you know, an implied right of action case. It went to the regulatory regime. And Jackson, as your opposing counsel said, and as we've talked about, deals with retaliation regarding an employee. And so we're really being asked to extend something. And the other problem is, that was problem one, is the holding. Problem two is the Supreme Court now, for better or for worse, has completely shifted how it looks at private causes of action. It went from the Court versus Ash regime, where it asked for factors and went through a bunch of things, to essentially telling us don't do it unless it's there or there's pretty darn good evidence that it's there. And if it's not there in the text, don't do it. And so we're in don't do it land, and we're asked to extend something, and I'm just having trouble with getting
We're in don't do it land where there is an express right of action under a different statute, right. Too.
I understand that, Your Honor, and it is our position that this does not constitute an extension, because Cannon said that there is a right of action for those who are covered in the statute, because Bell said the statute uses the language any person. It does not say students or beneficiaries or people getting educated under the program. So the Supreme Court has held There's a private right of action already existing for people who are covered under the Title IX, the language of Title IX, and it has specifically held that the language of Title IX includes employment discrimination. So I do believe that this is a pre-existing right of action. This would not be an extension. This would not be a creation of a right that doesn't exist. When we look at the case law, the reading of the statute already brings this right of action into existence. The fact that this particular fact pattern hasn't come before the court yet, I mean, it's sort of coincidental because the Supreme Court's rulings in interpreting the statutory text, even looking at a strict textual interpretation like they did in Jackson, specifically covers this and is not an extension of it. We're not creating a new right here.
But, correct. Speaking of textualism, you know, we're all textualists now. Kagan tells us since Scalia came along. What is the text of the implied cause of action? You know, we've interpreted Title VII in, on the retaliation thing, and I authored the opinion and held my nose and my pen and everything else when I authored it. But if you look at the literal text of the anti-retaliation provision in Title VII, it protects the harasser from retaliation for participating in a deposition and saying, yeah, I did harass her. And then in that case, the company fired him. And we said, can't do that because it says any person. All right, is that language implied into Title IX? Where do we look when we have those kind of application issues?
So, Your Honor, if I'm understanding the question correctly, the text of Title IX itself specifically says any person who's discriminated on the basis of sex under a federally funded education.
I'm talking about the retaliation clause. Title IX doesn't copy the retaliation clause from Title VII, or there would be no need for an implied cause of action.
Correct. There's no separate statutory provision similar to the Title VII exception.
So again, what was implied, inferred,
right,
searching inquiry, imagination, inferred from Title IX for anti-retaliation? Do we say, oh, they must have meant exactly the words that are in Title VII?
What the Supreme Court held in Jackson is functionally that that the definition of intentional discrimination based on sex includes retaliation. And so, you know, I do want to make a point.
I know, but they didn't say, Title VII doesn't just say you can have a cause of action for retaliation. They define what retaliation is in very broad terms. Now, is it your position that Title IX, via the Supreme Court decision, incorporated that language from Title VII?
It is not my position that Title IX incorporates the specific identical language from Title VII. My position is that what the court ruled in Jackson is that retaliation is a form of intentional discrimination writ large, and that is covered in the text of Title IX.
I have failed to convey to you that the question is what in the particulars, down in the weeds. Because as soon as we say it won't matter, there'll be a case raising exactly that issue. What is retaliation? It seems to me that the simple answer, although I've never seen it anywhere and it has all kinds of judicial process problems, is they just lifted the language, just to lift the language out of seven and put it in nine. But nobody wants to admit that we're adding language to a statute, but that's precisely what they're doing. I'm venting. I'm sorry.
No,
go ahead.
So let me ask this. Let's assume for the moment that I agree with you that you can combine these cases together and have implied that which exists, at least with regard to the discrimination side of it. I want to get to the retaliation side of it because I think you have an issue there too, but let's assume for the moment. So as I understand it, POM tells us to look at three things, right? The text, structure, and history. Text seems to be pretty easy since it doesn't exist, right? I mean, that's if you're weighing that factor, it's lack of existence forget the preclusion part or whether it's implied, that it doesn't exist has to mean something. And that seems to weigh in favor of Title VII precluding Title IX. If you look at structure, it seems to me that when you have this, and the Supreme Court has said it in those cases that your opposing counsel talked about, when you have these administrative procedures that are all set up and exhaustion requirements that are set up for the sole purpose of filtering claims and investigating good ones and sort of putting aside bad ones, and you have a system that can sort of subvert that by this implied right of action, that also seems to weigh in favor of preclusion. And then the last one, history, the sequence of the amendments would seem to suggest that Congress meant to include education in Title VII, and by not implying the right of action, or by not giving an explicit cause of action in the 72 amendments when it created it, meant to filter everything through Title VII. So in all three, it seems that the it seemed it would be precluded. But that, tell me where I'm missing something.
I'll do my best to sort of approach each prong.
Thanks. I try to do it in order.
So with respect to the text, it is true that Title IX does not create an express right of action, but that issue's already been long settled that it includes a right of action.
And so, well, it doesn't include it. It means we believe Congress meant to imply it, but it we can't say it exists. It does not exist as a matter of text.
As a matter of explicit text, that's correct. But the Supreme Court has implied it based upon the text and upon the legislative history.
As opposed to invisible text.
It's in the numbers.
The Supreme Court has repeatedly admonished the courts to take heed of its language that Title IX has to be afforded a scope as broad as its language. And the language is deliberately very broad. And the Supreme Court has reiterated numerous times over 40 or 50 years, including recently in the Jackson case, that it is important that we give it the broad scope that Congress intended. So the congressional intent of Title IX is well established under Supreme Court precedent, that it was intended to be extremely broad in scope to address the scourge of discrimination in educational programs.
Let me ask you this. If we buy your argument completely, would a plaintiff in this plaintiff's position ever file under Title VII instead of IX?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a point that I'm glad the court raised, because it's an argument, this sort of like free-floating policy argument is, the claim is that if we allow Title IX claims here, essentially Title VII will be repealed, it will be ignored, no one will ever use it. First of all, the plaintiff in this case did actually file with the EEOC, so he did not skirt the Title VII.
But didn't file a Title VII claim.
He did not ultimately amend to include the Title VII claim, but he did not skirt the administrative requirements.
Why? Stop. Why didn't he?
I don't think I'm equipped to answer that question with all due respect, Your Honor.
You mean your skills in law school weren't developed to survive? What do you mean?
To the extent that it involves a discussion between the client and the attorney, I think it would fall under the privilege. I don't think that I can disclose that sort of information. I personally wasn't part of that conversation, so even if I didn't think it was outside of the, I don't personally have that knowledge. But what I want to point out with respect to this argument that we're sort of decimating Title VII is there are already situations in which the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled in Johnson and in the CBOCS Humphreys case that there already are classes of employees who can skip over the Title VII enforcement scheme and file directly with court. And there has been no evidence, no statistics, no reports, no anything in the record presented by the board that says this has undermined Title VII, that employees aren't using the Title VII administrative scheme, that we've essentially...
Well, if they're still using it, why go to the problem of all these problems by implying a cause of action?
Well, as I've stated, Your Honor, our position is that the cause of action does already exist under the precedent. And so the idea is that we're following the congressional intent in enacting Title VII. There are numerous statements in the enacting Congress that enacted the statute to the extent that it's intended to have a broad reach. It is specifically not intended to be preclusive. It's supposed to be a supplement to other existing rights under federal statutes, other available rights. The Title VII statute...
But they didn't put that in the statute.
Correct. They did not write their reasoning directly into the statute, but they did provide an explanatory memorandum, which is referenced in the Gardner-Denver case, it's referenced in the dissent in Brown, it's referenced in the Johnson case, that there was an expressed intent that it would be a supplementary remedy intended to give sort of the broadest range of remedies possible for employees who are suffering from discrimination.
Before you're out of time, I want to ask you about the retaliation side. So that seems to me to also implicate the implied right of action part, and that is that you seem to be bringing a claim that Jackson didn't contemplate and that I can't find any published case that seems to support, and that at least one circuit has suggested doesn't exist. What do we make of that in the preclusion analysis?
So the Jackson court, I would say there's sort of two parts in the Jackson decision. The first part of the decision is simply deciding that retaliation writ large is included within the private right of action under Title IX. And it was an employee there bringing the retaliation claim. A separate part of that section was whether retaliation existed for a complaint that other third parties were being treated in a discriminatory manner. So if anything...
About the failure to comply with Title IX.
Correct, about discriminatory treatment under Title IX. So if anything, I think that was a broader reach than the case we're talking about here, because we're just talking about a direct retaliation. He submitted submitted reports and complaints, appeals to the HR department, complaining about the way that he was treated. So that is he made the retaliation claim, and he was, ultimately functionally terminated after that. And I do, for what it's worth, the district court found that the complaint alleged retaliation. So I'm not sure that portion of the court is what was certified to this court for review. In the Crowder case specifically. And I know that I'm out of time, but if I could just make one last very quick point about the specific versus broad statutes. The cases, the primary cases that they rely on, when we talk about cases like Novotny or the Pressier case, they're cases where the plaintiffs were trying to use non-substantive remedial statutes in order to, as a pass-through statute, basically, to assert Title VII claims, to assert claims that had fall under other statutes with specific requirements. That the court has repeatedly refused to allow. You can't make a Title VII claim through the pass-through statute of 1985. But that's not what we're doing here. We're making a separate claim that's under a separate right. And what the court pointed out in the Novotny case was that in the Novotny case, it distinguished Johnson because it was...
I know. You got to make this fast. This is really going on.
I apologize. Essentially, the plaintiff had two separate sources of substantive rights. And so in this case, the plaintiff has two separate sources of substantive rights. He's not seeking to use a broader statute in order to assert his Title VII rights. He's seeking to use Title IX in order to assert his Title
IX. I think we understand the point.
Thank you, and I apologize for going
over. That's okay. General Petrone.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just four quick points. The first, just to respond to that last point. Johansson, Demko, Pricer were all situations of two different substantive statutes. So it's not like the preclusion cases are just in that context.
Can I ask you a question about the certified question to us? Because she raised that, and it's actually a question that I had. The certified question is limited. It says discrimination. It doesn't reference retaliation. Now, that doesn't mean we can't read it to be the claims that were brought, especially since it's all from the same sort of discrimination statutes. But what do we make of that? Are we limited to just the discrimination claims?
Well, you certainly are not, to the extent that you resolve the question by taking a step back and resolving the previous legal question. So what I mean by that...
It really doesn't even go that far. We've held that that's just a key to the jurisdictional kingdom, and we can decide anything in the case.
Well, that was going to be my second point as well. Yeah. I also don't think there'd be any jurisdictional problems because you already granted the appeal. It's all bound up in the same matter. But the other three quick points I want to make, of course this would be an extension. If the argument is, well, can you set up a private right of action, and North Haven said it covers any person, so there's no extensions of the private right of action anymore, you wouldn't have Franklin and Gebser and Jackson analyzing, do we in fact extend the private right of action here? Sometimes they did, sometimes they did not. And I think the reason that counsel on the other side is conflating those things is to avoid the fact that cases like Bell, we're talking about the substance of what is prohibited, not the private right of action itself. Because, of course, you have the administrative enforcement textually in the statute. And what the statute prohibits versus where the private right of action reaches, the implied one, are not the same thing. I do think Title VII in the sex discrimination and employment context at universities and schools would be effectively a dead letter. I mean, it's true that plaintiffs, there's no reason a lot of times not to include both if you've already exhausted, but you don't have to, and you won't have to exhaust if Title IX just takes over the substantive area. And the last point that I'm gonna make is Title VII has text to interpret, and Title IX barely does. And the answer to Judge Karn's question of like, what is this thing? It's necessarily going to be bound up in kind of judicial policymaking, this sort of like, well, should a private right of action exist for this sort of thing or not? I think the Supreme Court long ago stopped doing that and has told lower courts to stop doing that, and I don't think this court should resurrect that practice here. So I'm happy to answer any questions the court has. Otherwise, I'll cede the rest of my time.
So you would say that any claim for employment that's in the employment field, really, that's Title VII's your exclusive remedy, regardless of whether the claim about employment discrimination is discrimination against you, the employee, based on your sex, as opposed to discrimination that affected you because you were, say, the head coach of the women's basketball team, even though you're a male.
Yes, Your Honor, with the caveat that if Title VII doesn't actually capture the conduct, I can't speak to every other imaginable statute out there, but I don't think you should extend Title IX, the private right of action there, to cover that conduct, because I think that would be going beyond what the Supreme Court has said in terms of extending private rights of action. There might be some other statute that addresses the conduct.
And the reason for not doing that for the employee in the Title IX context, even though the court has done it, for the employee for a retaliation right or for the student in canon is what?
Well, so in terms of retaliation, as I said before, there's a serious concern that the actual administrative enforcement would not be possible.
I get that.
Yeah, when it comes to canon, I think there the basic point is canon only decided it with respect to students. I think that case would come out differently today. And I don't think that the Supreme Court, let me phrase this differently. I think the Supreme Court has made very clear to lower courts, don't do the thing we were doing back in the 70s anymore. I mean, I think that's the answer to that question.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Really appreciate it. HM versus